Welcome to the LeanZone.com podcast, where we discuss construction contracts, liens, and bonds. And now, our host, Alex Barthet.
All right, so my name's Alex Barthet. I'm a board-certified construction attorney. I work with my father. We have 10 lawyers in downtown Miami. All we do is construction. We help construction companies deal with contracts, liens, bonds, collections. But today, we're going to talk about what is in your contract. I had a client come into my office about a month ago, and he came into my office and he sat down and he put a contract on my desk and he said, "All right, Alex, I signed it. What does it say?" I said, "Well, you know, there's nothing I can do for you now, right? You know that." He says, I know. I should have called you yesterday before I signed it." So you have to read and understand what's in your contract. So let's talk about what should be in your contract to protect you. You should include in your contract the scope of work you intend to provide. You should be detailed. If you're going to provide a specific thing by model number, list that. The more detail, the better. People come to me because there's a problem, and that problem usually stems from a misunderstanding about what should have been done in that contract. Those things almost always are something the client probably could have anticipated, but didn't take the time to list any exclusions or assumptions in their contract. So, in your business, there are things that you know that you don't do, that are not in your price, that your price is premised upon. My price is premised upon, you know, the site being available to work, that I'm a foundation contractor, that there's only 2 feet of muck and not 6 feet of muck, right? Those are the types of things that you want to list as assumptions and exclusions in your contract. It may kill the deal because now you're stating the obvious of what may be a problem in the future. But isn't it better to know now about a problem that's going to happen later than to not say anything and then have to deal with it when that assumption or that exclusion comes into play? So again, think about your business. Think about, you know, in the last 12 to 24 months, where were the pain points? What were the things that people complained about? And list them in your contract. So the next time someone shows up and says, "Oh, wait, I thought that was included," you can flip the contract over and you can say, "No, you know, paragraph 6E says that that's not part of my contract." Understand and clarify change orders. This is a big deal in construction. So in construction, changes happen all the time. Maybe the site is different than expected. Something happens with the plans and specifications. So you need to be prepared for changes in the course of your construction contract because that's where most of the disputes come into play. So if you know that that's where the disputes are, then you want to make sure that you understand the change order process. How are change orders going to be approved? How are they going to be accepted? Do you do the work before you start the change order? The answer is no, by the way. Do you submit your change order and then wait until you get it approved? You have to look at to see what your contract says. How are you going to get paid? That's the next thing you need to understand. How are you going to get paid? What are the terms and conditions of payment? And how well are they articulated in your contract? You need to know what are the steps in order to be paid so that you can make sure you check all the boxes and get paid. Your contract should not be ambiguous about when you get paid. A couple of things to keep in mind. If you trigger payment on a series of events, you have to be aware that it's possible that those events may not occur. Right? So as an example, if you are in construction and you say, "My final payment is due upon the issuance of a certificate of occupancy," well, what happens if you can't get the CO because the designer that's been hired by the owner hasn't done what they needed to do, right? So think about worst case scenarios when it comes to payment and try to account for those in the course of your contract drafting. You're always better off using a date, you know, a point in time on the calendar, than you are a triggering event, if you're the person getting paid, by the way. And to the extent you are reviewing a contract where you have to pay somebody, ideally you want it the other way around. So if I have a contract with an owner, I want to say that my final payment is due at the earlier of certificate of occupancy or June 7th. That makes it very clear when I'm going to get paid. If I'm going to hire a subcontractor, maybe I'm going to hire a plumber, I want to say that I don't have to pay you until you close out your permits. And then I don't want to put a date, right? So remember, there's two sides to every contract. You want to remember which side you're on. In construction, we deal with a contract term that's called pay when paid, which is pretty unique to construction. What it means is, generally, if the owner doesn't pay the contractor doesn't have to pay the subs and all the way down the line, which is a tremendous shifting of the risk associated with getting paid in construction. You need to understand if your contract has a pay when paid provision. To the extent you do work with anybody that's at all sophisticated, I would tell you that it probably has a pay when paid provision in it. So if you're thinking, well, it says I'm going to get paid in 30 days after submission of my payment application for a construction contract, well, if it also says that that's subject to the owner paying the contractor, that could be a problem. So understand when and how you're going to get paid.
This episode is brought to you by the Miami Construction Forum. This invitation-only group of construction professionals of all sizes and trades meets monthly for an informal lunch-and-learn session on current topics of interest, from getting paid and safety to bonding and insurance. To see the upcoming topics and request your invitation, visit MiamiConstructionForum.com.
This is especially important in construction, but also has applications in other parts of, in other industries. But is to include the right to stop work. Most construction contracts that we see actually say that if we have a dispute, and if even if I'm not paid, I have to keep working, and I can start the dispute resolution process. Now, that dispute resolution process may mean that we go to mediation, maybe we go to court, maybe we go to arbitration, but I have to keep working. I have to keep paying my labor. I have to keep supplying materials to the job. That's a difficult thing to do for most businesses, especially a small business, right? So you're not getting paid, and now you have to pay a lawyer to fight to get paid while you're still doing the job. So one of the things you want to do in your construction contract, but again, even to the extent you have a different type of business, you want to make sure that you include an express right to stop work. What does that mean? That means that it says that if you haven't been paid in a certain amount of time, 15 days, 30 days, 60 days, that you have the right to stop working. It doesn't guarantee that you'll get paid. It just stops the bleeding. So for our construction clients that are typically subcontractors and below, this is a provision we would typically add to their contract, or a right to stop work. And then let's talk about how disputes get resolved generally. There's three, maybe four ways to resolve a dispute. So one, and typically the first one, is a meeting of executives, right? So there's a dispute as between you and me. The first step of the dispute resolution process could be, we have to meet within a certain amount of time, and then we have to talk about it and try to resolve it. If that doesn't work, then we go to mediation. Now again, all of these are contract terms. None of this is required by the law. But it's good, because if you can get a dispute resolved quickly, you're always better off than having that fight linger on and pay legal fees. So the next step after a meeting of executives would be mediation. Mediation is a process where the parties get together, they hire a third party neutral, typically a retired judge, or maybe an attorney who just focuses on resolving disputes. And you meet, everyone splits the cost of this person, and this person has no right to decide anybody's fate. what he or she does is makes everyone aware of the costs associated with having to have the fight, the strengths and weaknesses in their case. One of the things that happens that we see is that our clients, all clients, get a little blinded by their own case. They have a hard time removing themselves from the situation and realizing, wait a sec, does it make sense spending $20,000 over a $10,000 fight? Probably not, but you have to have someone help you through that process. Ideally, your attorney is telling you that, but if you have to resolve the dispute, one of the ways to maybe get it resolved more quickly is mediation. The next two are litigation and arbitration. Litigation is the default. If you and I have a handshake agreement and we have a dispute, we're going to go to court. That's litigation. A judge, paid by our taxes, is going to make a decision, or it could be decided by a jury. The process for litigation is generally slow. An average case takes between 6, if you're really lucky, and 24 months to move through the court system. To give you some perspective, for us as lawyers to have an opportunity to have the judge decide even a small issue usually takes 2 to 4 weeks before we are able to get in front of the judge. So if the other lawyer and I are unable to work something out, and we say, okay, we're going to have to go to court and have the judge decide this small issue, which takes 5 minutes of the judge's time, we're going to have that resolution is going to happen 2 to 4 weeks from now. If we need more than 5 minutes of the judge's time, it usually takes 2 to 3 months to get in front of the judge. So now just, you know, when you understand that, now you have an appreciation of why a case may take 2 years to get resolved, because every little step where the lawyers can't work it out ends up getting in front of a judge. The benefit of litigation is that it's somewhat predictable. Cases, other prior decisions of the court, act as precedent so that other people can rely on them. So you can more comfortably say, well, I have facts in a situation similar to this case, so the result should be similar to the outcome in that case. In arbitration, you effectively hire a private judge. It's either one or three. There's services that administer arbitration. The AAA is one. There's another one called JAMS. And you pay a fee, and they will connect you with arbitrators, and you pick the arbitrators with the other side. The benefit of arbitration is that it's private. It's not necessarily confidential, but it's private, so there's no public filings of anything. Number one. Number two, it is possibly faster, but not always faster, because the arbitrators can take a long time too. One of the things that it almost always is more expensive, because when you pay the arbitrators, which are these private judges that your attorneys pick, these arbitrators get paid just like lawyers, so they get paid $350, $400 an hour. So every time you have one of these hearings I'm telling you about, you know, it takes them an hour to prepare. They're on the phone with you for 20 minutes. I mean, it adds up. We have a client now who signed a contract that required arbitration with 3 arbitrators. So every time something happens, you know, it's running at like $1,000, $1,200 an hour, plus what he's paying us, plus what the other side is paying their lawyer. And they're not... they understand how this works, they, the arbitrators, so they want all their money up front. So before we even started the arbitration, the arbitrators wanted from each of us, each side, a check for $25,000. So before we even start the case, my client had to write a check. By the way, he's owed $180,000, right? So he's owed $180,000, he's paid us a little bit of money, and now he's got to write a check for $25,000 to this group of people so that they can decide his case. But that's what he agreed to. And if you agree in a written agreement with somebody that you're going to arbitrate your case, most judges are going to require you to arbitrate.
Thanks for listening to the LeanZone.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or in your favorite podcast app. For articles, videos, and forms on this and other construction topics, head over to theleanzone.com.